Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. Every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York podcast.
Yes, this is episode 104 of the podcast. You heard me. 104, I'm Dave, your host, as always, and today is the day I clean my air conditioner filter. Are you excited? Can you hear the excitement in my voice? As soon as I finish recording this, I'm going to go clean my filter. Very special day. Hey, today on the podcast, to mark the occasion, I'm going to give you a really cool talk. It's called If the Buddha Grew Up in New York. This is Shastri Ethan Nickturn and Dr. Shante Smalls, two teachers in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. Ethan Nickturn, as you know, is the author of a few books, including The Road Home, A Contemporary Exploration of the Buddhist Path, now out on paperback. Get your copy today. Dr. Shante Smalls is a longtime practitioner, also a professor at St. John's University. They are giving this really cool talk about the narrative of the awakenment of the Buddha and how that applies to modern life, perhaps the life of a modern person living in 21st century New York City or any other city, frankly. And this is a great talk. But before we get to that, I do want to mention that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York is presenting a retreat, a week-long meditation retreat, in New York City, at the Shambhala Center of New York. It's the week of August 19th. It's a seven-day retreat. You can do the whole 7 days, or you can register for a day or two or three. You can register by the day if the whole week seems daunting to you. I promise you, if you want to do the whole week, it is not daunting. It will be a fabulous experience. Acharya Hesse is a great teacher, senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. He is coming in, being flown in to New York, especially for this retreat, and we're very lucky to have him. For more information and to register, click the link on the homepage, nmaya.shambhala.org, for the 7-day urban retreat. And now, in a talk recorded at our weekly Dharma gathering a couple months ago, actually in early June, here is Shastri Ethan Nickturn and Dr. Shante Paradigm Smalls.
I'm going to paraphrase, but I read this Buddhist scholar who's also a Zen teacher and a really knowledgeable about postmodern thought, a man named David Loy. And he wrote a book called The Great Awakening, A Buddhist Social Theory. And the first paragraph of this book, he basically says, the Buddha, this person, lived in the Iron Age, in a different culture, in a culture that basically didn't have an understanding of science, didn't know how big the world was, didn't have things like democracy, didn't have things like pop art or hip-hop music or capitalism. What does this person have at all to say to us? And why do we assume that somebody from the Iron Age, from 2,600 years ago, has anything? Their story of what they did with their life speaks to us. So I think it's an interesting question, because often in Buddhist communities, the story of the life of the Buddha is told and retold. And it's an interesting thing that can happen when there's the story of another human being and their spiritual journey or their path of awakening. It can either really bring us closer if it somehow resonates with our human experience, but it can also distance us. You know, it's like one of the things that's not quite accurate but is often said about the Buddha is the Buddha was a prince. So does that mean you can't awaken if you weren't born a prince? It's an interesting question. So I think that's this sort of way of both of us kind of trained and Shante really teaches in a university, and I teach in a non-university environment. Although, sometimes they bring me in to just say a few Buddhist things, not for credit, to universities, which I use to further my reputation with friends like Shante, who I respect. Did you know I gave a lecture at Duke University?
What?
Yeah.
Really? Wow.
This spring. See? It works. But we were both trained in this way of looking at things where stories and culture are incredibly important, but they also need to be pulled apart, deconstructed. We are always telling, this is part of what our shamatha, our mindfulness meditation, is all about. We're always telling ourselves certain stories about who we are and what the world is. And mindfulness meditation allows us to actually question our survival outside of the construct of a thought storyline, which is a really important thing for a human being to learn how to do, right? Because if you go anywhere in the media these days, it's like stories are just being fired out of ray guns. Here's a story, right? Oh, I don't believe that story. I have this story. So it's really interesting to think about what is a story of awakening? What was the Buddha's story, and what are the kind of key components? So just for a little, like, modern, I don't know if we're actually going to talk about this, but the title of this talk, since we also both grew up in New York, is If the Buddha Grew Up in New York. I don't think that means we're going to write, like, an alternate novel version, although maybe we could at some point.
Skateboarding. And then he runs down the stairs to the A train and passes by a homeless person.
Right. Yeah.
And gets bed bugs.
Right.
I don't.
Yes. So I think if we looked at some of the sort of universal aspects of this life of the Buddha, what that could represent 2,600 years later for us, there's definitely something interesting that he is born a person of privilege in his society, who develops, and I think this is the key part, a deep curiosity into his own dissatisfaction. I think most of the time we have a very partial curiosity into our dissatisfaction, right? Like, I think everybody in this room is slightly uncomfortable right now. And everybody outside of this room is slightly to mostly uncomfortable right now. And what makes this gathering interesting is that at least us, maybe a lot of other people at different places in this city, are interested. Rather than like, how do I get away from my discomfort? How do I actually learn more about it? Right, so what experience in the life of the Buddha were you referring to with the A train story?
I mean, I was just riffing, but you know, part of what I was thinking about in relationship to this topic and generally in relationship to meditation and the kind of ways that we've received it in the West is, of course, with our own cultural history of kind of Orientalism, right, where we mystify things from the East in particular, and so that they become almost inaccessible, or that we think we have to try on something else in order to experience what we talk about here as a kind of basic humanity. And even the subtitle of the Shambhala Level 1 here is Feel Human Again. And so, in part, what is so, to me, important about Shakyamuni's story, the historical Buddha story, is that he was a human. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, one of the ways that I like to think about his story is he became more human. Mm. So he went from, he was a Siddhartha, and he was a prince, But in a lot of ways, he was disconnected from his humanity because he was disconnected from humanity, from other humanity. He was sheltered. but when he saw other humans who weren't in his social circle and that there was suffering and death, he was curious, as you were talking about. And that this quality, you know, remember that song, for those of you who are old enough, the I'm only human. I'm only human. Remember that one? Born to make mistakes, right? Like this idea that we're born to make mistakes and that our humanity is somehow incomplete or flawed or bad or is the actual problem. And from a Buddhist point of view, our humanity is actually the ground or the gift. And it contains all the elements that we need to wake up. Mm. They traditionally talk about the human life being precious, and that if we are in a position to be in this room or to meditate, then the conditions are favorable and we have some freedom. So there are people who are human who aren't free and who don't have favorable conditions. And so I think this idea that is maybe revolutionary. I mean, when you were talking about the Iron Age, I was thinking about how the Buddha's awakening transformed the world. This decision to experience humanity, his own humanity. So I guess I want to encourage us to step into our humanity and to enjoy it, because that's what affords us the opportunity to wake up. That's not to say there aren't non-human awakened beings, but we just communicate differently, so it's a little easier if we get that message from a human. Yeah.
So that one interesting thing about the life of the Buddha, which you alluded to, is that, and I always love this way of saying it, is that the Buddha pops out of his basically narcissistic father's sheltering. And it's said in the ancient text that he's visited by four divine messengers, which makes you think like angels, or I think of the Bill Murray, Charles Dickens movie, Scrooge.
Really?
That's what I think of as like a ghost comes and visits you. But these four divine messengers are, he sees a sick person, he sees an old person, he sees a corpse. And then the fourth one is he sees somebody, an ascetic who has, or a renunciate, who has devoted their life to spiritual practice. So he just sees four people, but with different human situations of suffering, and these are called the four divine messengers in ancient Buddhism. So we definitely can do that in New York.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You can have a divine messenger of what the sort of vulnerable limitations of a human life are anytime we want, right? That would be an interesting way to ride the subway. Like, when the subway stalled, and what's one of the number one reasons a subway stalls? Sick passenger. Instead of being like, well, why don't they get them off the train then? Just be like, oh, illness. Life is short. Somebody's ill. That would be a nice way to wake up from that message. So this real curiosity, this moving towards the facts of life, rather than like, how do I avoid them, is I think the first part of any awakening narrative. And the second one that we thought of is there has to be some journey of loneliness. which is really interesting. In the Buddha's life, he literally left society behind, which, you know, we often do in this tradition. Oftentimes we do it together in group retreats where we're working together, but sort of outside, whether it's just a day or a weekend here at the center or going away to a retreat center where you actually get away from the structures and relationships of your life for a little while and experience your own heart and mind and really work with them deeply. So that's interesting. Like, does a journey of loneliness mean you have to reject your life in the world and go forth? I'll talk about the Shambhala reinterpretation of this narrative at the end, but not necessarily. Where are we going to go? To a hut in Prospect Park? Or? Maybe you can Airbnb a hut in the wilderness. But there is some journey of being willing to realize that a relationship with oneself has to be part of the journey of awakening. It could come from, we all get by with a little help from our friends and teachers, but the Buddha, supposedly the thing that makes him the Buddha, because there have been many Buddhas, the thing that makes him a special awakened being is he didn't have a teacher for the path of awakening. He had teachers in meditation, but he really had to work with his own mind. He had to experience aloneness and loneliness, something personal. Do you want to say more to that one?
Has anyone in this room ever experienced loneliness? Has anyone not experienced loneliness? Maybe that's... And I think it's curious, too, that... I mean, this is a trope. It's not... I'm not going to say anything new here, but that we live in a city of 8 million plus, and we live in a world of, I don't know how many, 6 trillion plus, close to 7 trillion people, and we experience tremendous loneliness. And we think there's something wrong. There is something wrong. But there's something right in the sense that we have this wisdom that wants us to connect. And maybe we've been taught that the connection is through things or through liquids or through exchange of fluids or through... objects or through Netflix, one of my favorite connections, through food or through fantasy. But part of the beauty of meditation, when we maybe sit for the first time or the 100th time, is that we're actually not trying to get rid of this sense of loneliness or this feeling of tenderness, actually, maybe. Maybe we narrate it as loneliness, but maybe it's just tenderness or softness, softness that we couldn't have when we were children in our home. Our home wasn't a safe place maybe for tenderness. Or maybe our home was safe, but our neighborhood wasn't a safe place for vulnerability and tenderness. Or maybe our neighborhood was safe, but our school wasn't safe, or so on and so forth. And so we learn to shield it, like the way a turtle tucks in its head into the shell when there's a threat. But when we sit on the cushion, all of that comes up. And that tenderness, that vibration, that turbulence is right there. And we're sensing something. We might qualify it as loneliness, but it's also a tenderness. And one of the things that meditation teaches us is that there's nothing wrong with us. And that this path is actually pretty well worn. So when we sit, and it's not about like, I don't know, I'll just tell a quick story that when I first started kind of in this phase of my life meditating again, I had all kinds of ideas about what a meditator was, and I had to have the right wrist malas and the right, you know, cushion and the bells and the, all the external stuff so that I looked like a meditator. But even getting on the cushion in a room full of people like this, I experienced tremendous loneliness, tremendous doubt, tremendous fear of what? That I was a fraud, that I was a bad meditator, which is a hilarious, I don't know, there's like really no one evaluating my, this is not, except me, you know, it's not like, there's no, you know, award for meditation except for it, some stability. But I thought, I can't be here because I'm not good enough. And what happened is that instead of running away from that feeling through my own habitual patterns, I kind of trusted when teachers said, like Ethan and other teachers said, that's okay, that's part of the process. And there was nothing else really in society was telling me it was okay to experience my own loneliness, and that was actually the same pool of wisdom and brilliance. Mm. That it wasn't like when I got rid of my loneliness, I would discover my awesomeness.
Right.
That was my awesomeness.
Right.
You know? So Shakyamuni he did this. And then he told other people about it.
Yeah, yeah. So the third thing we came up with, and I always think of the Buddha this way, is like, we all respect this in ourselves. People respect this about us. We respect it in other people. That quality, maybe you have a friend who's just really great in a certain discipline like art or sports or CrossFit. Like, I am fascinated by how my soon-to-be wife can get up and both meditate and like work out in the morning with such rigor and discipline. The Buddha had insane discipline. And I don't mean that as the same thing as self-aggression or like self-torture. He actually tried self-torture. Basically, I've thought about sort of reframing that narrative. There was a period of his life where, I mean, it's a male narrative, it's an ancient narrative, but the best sort of modern association with it is he basically developed an eating disorder and then gave that up because it was too harsh. So that wasn't what he meant by... discipline. Discipline has this quality of, I will not give up until I am in harmony with my own experience. Like a person who wasn't willing to say, okay, I sort of understand my own mind, or okay, I sort of have developed compassion. I was nice to that one jerk, so I can be mean to this next person. Right? The quality of, until I attain a kind of complete sense of awareness, a complete befriending of myself, I'm not going to stop. And so sometimes, you know, I feel like this is lost in, 'cause our tradition, because we're such a society of self-torturers, we really focus on the gentleness aspect, which I think is good. Because otherwise you're going to give up very easy. If your meditation cushion just becomes your own personal torture device, it's not really going to help. So we focus on the gentleness aspect, but I really like this idea of somebody who is just like, this is what my life is about, awakening. And until I get there, it's not like I'm going to be torturing myself because he realized that if he wanted to do it, he had to get more gentle, more relaxed, more okay with who he was. But that sense of not giving up, you know, the same quality when somebody's, you know, trying to write a manuscript and they're like, I have so many obstacles, I'm afraid this might suck, but I'm not going to stop until I've reached the fruition. And that quality, I think, is that commitment. It's a really wonderful quality. And I think of Siddhartha, like, it's just that sort of, like, it doesn't have to be that you go sit for 6 years in the wildernesses of northern India or Nepal. It can just be like, I'm on this path. I'm going to do a little bit every day. If I forget to do it, I'm going to come back. If I forget to be compassionate, I'm going to practice again. It's that sort of, that commitment to returning to the path until a real sense of awareness and compassion dawns that I think is the third part of any awakened narrative. Just like, yeah, commitment. I say this the week before I'm getting married, so that's on my mind,
good.
Too.
No, this is good. When I was a kid, I was one of those kids who was, like, into, I wanted to try everything. So one week it was ballet, tap, and jazz. But then when we got to the ballet part, that was too hard, and I said, I'm done with this. And then the next week or month, whatever, it was gymnastics. And then when I had to do the pommel horse, I was like, no way. So that was over. And my mom was like, look, kid, you know, you're spending a lot of money. And there was this narrative that I was like, you know, couldn't stick to anything. And then, I'm 6 or 7, and I discover soccer. And all of a sudden, I was like, this is my thing. And for 12, 13 years, I was playing on teams, practicing year-round, going to camp, training my body, lifting weights, eating whatever ridiculous foods, and, you know, and that, I stuck with it as I grew and as it got harder and as the competition got more intense and as I met other talented kids and injuries, you know, getting kicked in the mouth. But there was no sense of, there was so much love and joy for this thing that the discipline wasn't like punishment. It wasn't like I got disciplined. It was like I got free through practicing. And it's been a very similar journey. The sense of, I'm going to sit on this cushion and I'm not going to get up until the time is up. And I'm going to do that every day or the best of my ability, you know, most days. And then all of a sudden, something happens. And I remember I was, may have been the first time I was assisting you in a class, one of the 6-week classes. And someone was asking a question about their practice, and Ethan said, maybe you can evaluate your practice every 10 years. And that was, I think I've been maybe practicing for 4 or 5 years, and I was like, okay, in 5 years, I'll be like, evaluate it. And so I've been practicing over 10 years now, and that's not the goal anymore. It's like, oh, I have a little bit of stability in my mind. I have a little bit of confidence, internal confidence, about my place on the planet. I have a little bit of more friendliness toward myself and others. I have a little bit more space, a pause between my thought that says, curse that person out, punch them in the head, whatever. I have a little bit of a pause, you know, some space between my instinct or my thought and my action. And that's the fruition of some discipline. Mm. You know, Yeah, and that it also connects a little bit with the back to the loneliness, because there is a sense that I think, or maybe this is just my own skewed view, but there is a sense that people who are disciplined sometimes, you know, are weirdos, right? That like everything is just easy. Like they have this new device, or they're developing that you can, instead of learning a language, you can just put in your ear and like it does simultaneous translation. No, that's cool.
That's straight out of Star Trek.
It's like Star Trek, or you know, whatever. Like, yeah, it's like definitely Star Trek. But there's also something lost cognitively, like literally in terms of your brain patterns, when you don't actually go through the process of learning another language. Mm. And so there are all these benefits. I'm not a Luddite. I love technology. There are all these benefits to the kind of expedient way. But there's also all this benefits to being disciplined.
Yeah.
And practicing.
Yeah. And I don't think there's a quick way to do this. There is a meditation app now that works with blood pressure and heart rates. Yeah, I can't remember the name of it, but it's already, I think it's $149. That's what I remember. That's the only part I remember. Maybe that can I think that can help with certain parts of mindfulness and stabilizing the parasympathetic nervous system, et cetera. I'm all for that. But if you're trying to form a relationship with yourself, that takes as long as forming a relationship takes. Mm-hmm. So anybody saying you can do it like that, it's like, well, that would be like going on. You can go on a date that lasts that long, or you can hang out with somebody and it's that long, or you can get married for that long. It's like, why would you want that? It's really about an ongoing relationship and the commitment to working with yourself in a relationship space. I think any Buddhist narrative kind of questions the sort of instantaneous solution model, because the question is always, then what happens? Mm-hmm. Then what happens? You're still you, dealing with being you among other people. And that is, I think, the last part to me of the Buddha's narrative is he saw something universal. And it was interesting in terms of the sort of social dimensions of his life and time was he, you know, we have a lot of narratives, a lot of confusion, I think, in our world around who is worthy to wake up. And he lived in a kind of brutal caste system, which he, in his own community, deconstructed. And he deconstructed it because he came to believe in something called awakened nature, that all humans and all beings actually have this sort of ability to connect with their own inherent goodness. And therefore, he had a desire to share something that was very personal. So that's the other side of loneliness, is some kind of connection based on shared experience. And for him, it meant some kind of reemergence into society after a physical period of loneliness, mm-hmm. which I don't know. That might be one of the main parts that I think the Shambhala teachings reframe. But do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think that sometimes, I'll say for myself, but sometimes, you know, when I initially was getting interested in meditation and in Buddhism, I was really like seduced by the concepts. Oh, we're all awakened beings. This is awesome. Blah, blah, blah. When I'm a Buddha, I can fly around. Like, this is going to be so cool. And like, this is like what I thought, you know? And and I also was like, I'm going to start with the most difficult situation, the most despicable, you know, situation, or most the person who was the most enemy in my mind or in history or whatever. And it was suggested to me that maybe I start a little closer to home, like my roommate at the time. I was like, oh yeah, I guess we have we're having a silent war over who buys the toilet paper. So, yeah, that I could start there. Because I wanted to win, right? And I was like, I don't remember what it was about, but there was something about toilet paper, and it was in my mind, it was a, this was war, you know, and I was going to show her, you know, and so I was like, oh, I can, you know, start where you are, as they say, or, you know, I also had to start with, you know, I still have, you know, rescue dog, and I was like, this dog, anyway. So I named him after this Indian Buddhist saint, Talopa. Every time I tell like a Buddhist, they're like, "You're crazy because that." And you know, there was like I learned a lot about my own rage, how concerned I was about what people think. Because when you're walking your dog and you have a dog that tries to bite everyone who walks by, people say things to you, and the amount of embarrassment I had about this sweet dog who was so terrified of the world that I had to get help, you know, pay someone to help me learn about this dog. And so I learned a lot about myself, that I was so concerned about my appearance, that was the most valuable thing to me. It's how I appeared to the world. And then I had this animal who just pierced that left and right. They were like, oh, you're the lady with the crazy dog. I'm like, no, I'm the amazing human being who adopted this troubled animal. Like, that was, you know, that was my narrative, you know what I mean? And so it was like, no, that's not the experience other people are having, you know, and I can't make them have my experience of me. So yeah, like this real this real quality of you know, being in the world and, you know, being irritated by people in the world, getting information from the world, you know, is really, really important because particularly in Shambhala, we talk about, we want all of society to be awake. You know, not just me individually or you or people who meditate or people who call themselves meditators, people who call themselves Buddhists, but everyone in society. So I have to learn how to work in, you know, how do I respond to the neighbor who likes to drum at 11 o'clock at night, or the colleague who I find, you know, irritating or bossy or whatever, or the, I like the Showtime people, but the kids on them, but I know a lot of people find those kids irritating who break dance. I like them. I was like, yay. But, you know, or the person who interrupts my podcast or whatever, to ask for money, right? So I get a lot of feedback from the world, whether I want it or not.
Yeah. So just to close and then open it up for discussion, the Shambhala teachings and the Shambhala symbolism have a very crucial reconstructing of the narrative of an awakened being as the center of the shrine, which is that the Siddhartha, who we don't have on our shrine, which is interesting for a Buddhist center to not have the historical Buddha on your shrine, represents a kind of leaving the world behind and then returning to the world. What we have on the center of our shrine is the Rigdon. And the Rigdon were these queens and kings of the mythical or mystical, whichever way you want to think about that, kingdom of Shambhala, which was supposedly an enlightened kingdom where beings knew how to treat themselves and knew how to treat each other. and represents a person who used meditation and used the teachings of the Buddhist tradition, but did the entire thing as a leader in society. So the narrative of loneliness, the narrative of commitment, the narrative of seeing dissatisfaction and transforming it, the narrative of reemerging into the world to share and work with others, all happens without leaving the world behind. That's that story. That's why the Buddha is not, it's a version of an awakened story, but it's our version of it. And that's why that's, and the primordial Rigdon, which is sort of the transcendent experience of this awakened leadership in society, is meant to be drawn with androgynous features. I'm not sure what it has. It's sort of an Asian look about it. But it could be drawn many different ways, right? But that's what the narrative represents. So I just want to say that because you've all been sitting and maybe have sat before in front of this huge, huge tanka, and it's nice to know what the story is, right? Because, again, the world is constantly, we have screens, big screens in front of us all the time shooting storylines at us. It would be nice to know what they represent, right? To at least be aware of the storyline. So that's our storyline. Any thoughts or
questions
or comments or insights?
Thank you both so much. I wondered if you'd talk about Muhammad Ali.
Oh.
Who, to me, was so extraordinarily enlightened to stand up against the war, etc.
Yeah. Yeah. It's I'm having an interesting experience right now because it's so sad that we lost him. He was a social revolutionary. But here's how multiple storylines... Did you see the movie When We Were Kings?
No.
It's about his fight with George Foreman in Africa. And
Rumble in the Jungle.
Rumble in the Jungle. And I just left that feeling like George Foreman was such a kind, compassionate person. And Muhammad Ali felt a little arrogant to me. So that's an interesting experience of multiple storylines. That movie made me a George Foreman fan.
Yeah, he was complex, you know.
I mean, in some ways, he was iconic, of course. And it's interesting that he was a pugilist, that he was a boxer. Mm. And in some ways, I think boxers and a lot of times, particularly black athletes, are kind of rendered as all muscle, you know, or all raw talent, right? And not kind of... I've tried boxing, and it's really hard. Anyway, but it's a skill, right? A skill set, and also it's an incredibly brutal... Mm. sport, and that he also in the ring he was so powerful and so skilled, and he was also kind of speaking at a time when it was just so dangerous. It puts such a target on his person, and then also he converted to Islam. I mean, it was just like, you know, at this time when he really he must have been quite lonely, actually.
Yeah.
And like he must have been quite lonely, actually, in many ways. And he did try different communities and Nation of Islam, and he broke away from them. And I think he's an interesting figure who was, you know, very complex. And but he had the ability to also wake us up, which I think is also really interesting. Mm-hmm. When someone can do that through their actions or through their speech, I think that's. Yeah. Profound. And to some people, he wasn't. You know, I was reading other comments, and some people felt like he's a draft dodger, and he was a traitor. And so it's interesting to hold all of the responses to that. Kind of like,
right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's also, we seem to have this social narrative, too. This is one of the things I always think about is that you're supposed to stick to your own area of life. So, like, a sports star is not supposed to have a political perspective. A spiritual teacher is not supposed to have a political perspective, which makes zero sense when you actually deconstruct that narrative. They would be actually, this pope should be what every pope ever has been.
He's
and he should talk to the Dalai Lama, right? That's an interesting thing about somebody who's not willing to stay in their societal narrative. So, but I love George Foreman too. That's all I was saying. He felt like a real gentle presence in that movie. But that's what I think of is like, it's interesting to not buy into the narrative that we have socially created, you know? And to step out of your box a little bit. That's what I think meditation is. It's realizing you can survive stepping out of your narrative. Mm-hmm. It's not going into a bliss state. It's not transcending anything. It's just stepping out of your storyline again and again.
Thank you both for the conversation. I've been enlightened a few times just listening to you. But the Muhammad Ali and some of the things you said make me think about the limits of discipline and the limits of what it means to be human in the face of adversity, let's say. So if you think about what many of the people during the civil rights movement went through, how they were able to confront so much pain again and again with humanity, I wonder where's the limit of that? Like, at what point do we say, I need to remove myself from this situation, or I need to change these circumstances?
In our tradition, discipline is always balanced by gentleness. They sort of facilitate each other, but if you just have one, like gentleness without discipline is laziness, really. It's kind of like avoidance, actually. And discipline without gentleness is self-aggression. And in the case of receiving the pain and suffering of the world over and over again, if there was no gentleness, you would probably just be taking on, you know, at best you would have compassion fatigue. At worst, you could be traumatized by just taking on too much brutality, too much confusion, too much suffering. So it's that's part of, it's said, what a good meditation practice is, kind of a microcosm for working with our mind in a way that we're holding our seat, which is the discipline part, which is like if you sit down for 10 minutes, you actually stay for 10 minutes. That's the discipline part. But within those 10 minutes, you're also letting yourself be, and that's the gentleness part. You're not forcing it to be a certain way. So I think with working in a really difficult world, sometimes you need Netflix. It's okay to be a Buddhist practitioner in 2016 and watch Netflix sometimes, but then there should be a message from your own path of like, okay, that's too much gentleness. That's what we call binge watching, too much gentleness. And if you're never enjoying yourself, that's self-aggression, right? And I think that's what this whole path is we each try to figure out how to balance that. And I think working with meditation, the discipline aspect is you show up for your practice. The gentleness aspect is you don't try to make your mind be other than it is. Make your experience be other than it is.
I think we also develop emotional intelligence. And so part of our emotional intelligence is being able to respond to situations organically. So, you know, much of what Ethan said. So we begin to develop a sense of balance and some wisdom about what situations we want to work with. And so it may not be that we want to work with the most frontline situation, right? It may be some other kind of work. But no matter what it is, that there has, that I think compassion doesn't mean stupidity. Mm-hmm. Compassion is super intelligent.
Right.
Real compassion is very smart. It's clear. It's not coming from a place of should. What should I do? What does this look like? It's more organic, and it's much more powerful than that. So, you know, we don't need to put ourselves in the most brutal situation if that's actually not what we can handle. No, part of me knowing myself is I know what situations I can't be a benefit to myself and others if I'm actually, you know, drowning in the circumstances. Mm-hmm. So I have to find a situation that's workable for me. And there, I can do that work from there, you know? So I don't know if I could have been one of those people getting, you know, sprayed by hoses and dogs and, not sprayed by dogs, but, you know, bit.
You can definitely deal with dogs, though.
You know, and spit upon and, you know, and so these people, I would say they trained, right? Mm. They were also a community. Rarely do people do things alone. People prepared, you know, all the people in SNCC and all the other various movements that we know of and we don't know of. And many of them were also willing to lose their lives. So the kind of, in some ways, we've watered down the message that was quite radical, and radical in the sense that it pierced through the status quo and said this is no longer acceptable. And so we've had many moments like that in this country and in this world. So it's kind of like, yeah, you have to, don't go it alone, you know? I mean, Ethan's my meditation instructor, you know? Sakyong and Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche are my teachers, and I have the Sangha, and I have friends who are outside the Sangha, and I have, you know, so it's never a sense of I'm going to go it alone.
Right. Right. The experience of loneliness doesn't mean you are alone. It just means you experience loneliness as you share the path with friends, which is an interesting combination, but that is the way it is.
I also just want to say very quickly that one of the most difficult things that I've experienced in meditation is that it was very hard for a long time to shed my idea of what I should be experiencing. Oh, I meditate. I should be nice to everyone. Mm. Oh, I got mad at someone. Oh, no. You know, I'm in meditation demerit or whatever, you know. And, like, part of becoming human is discovering all these patterns, habitual patterns. And that's that I'm going to have conflict with others and conflict with myself. And learning how, through meditation and other things, therapy, you know, whatever else, learning how to work with my mind, really my heart, but learning how to work with this my mind, right? It's just here. And not being like, oh, darn, I didn't do, you know, what my idea of that. I'm never going to awaken now. So just that caution that, like, wherever I'm at, whatever I'm working with is what I'm working with. Those are my circumstances, you know.
One more, and then we'll move on to the non-existent cheese.
No cheese.
I thought it was really interesting when you were talking about the Rigdon, how you said it could be mythical or mystical depending on your view. And I actually only recently just learned about the Shambhala Kingdom. Mm. And I was struck by how mystical the language seemed to me. It almost sounded like a folklore. And to be honest, that's an aspect of Buddhism that I haven't really connected with as much. I tend to, you know, I was attracted to the Buddhist practice because of the way it seems sort of grounded in the everyday. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that balance in Buddhism between the mystical and the everyday.
This is because every tradition has certain stories, even if your story is we don't like stories, which is kind of the atheist tradition. That's their story, right? That's kind of the point of what we've been saying is there always is a story and there's always a need to step out of it at the same time. The Tibetan tradition, which we descend from, has the most sort of combination of down-to-earth scientific, what are you observing right now, with a more mystical narrative or folklore going on. It's just, it's an interesting, the history of Tibet is an interesting combination of like psychology with a more shamanistic, nativistic spirituality. So it's a really interesting hybrid. And the kingdom of Shambhala is a folklore that existed in Tibet and other Himalayan regions of some kind of utopian, almost lost city of Atlantis place. And so, you know, it's interesting. Whenever there's a folklore, myth or mysticism, it's an interesting... to me, it kind of doesn't matter because it's about the observer's engagement with the story is really, you know, that's what creates the story. And then... The really interesting thing to me is as the teachings of this tradition go forward, one of the main things you learn in the Vajrayana or the, what's sometimes called the tantric portion of these teachings is you can actually work with the story that your mind is projecting and shift it. And you can work with that boundary between like, there is no story, let's step out of the story, and let's shift my narrative. If I'm going to walk around visualizing everybody as basically bad and out to get me, what if I could practice visualizing you all as Buddhas and actually ritualizing that? And am I making that up? Are we making up like Donald Trump? Or is he a shared visualization of where our society is at? That's what nobody wants to, that's the really uncomfortable truth that this tradition goes into is if you are perceiving something, your own mind is implicated in it. Not to say that you made it up, but if we are perceiving it, we are implicated in what we're perceiving. So it tests the boundary between myth and mysticism and reality, and that's, I think it's an interesting testing of the boundary, you know. But it's also nice to have cultural stories, you know. It's like growing up in New York. There's certain things about growing up in New York in the 80s and 90s that are shared.
Canal jeans.
Yeah. And if you came here later, you're considered foreign to the narrative, and we may or may not integrate you. And then you guys can create your own hipster narratives or whatever it is you brought with you, and then that becomes its own, you know. So there's something about a shared, any group has a shared story. I went to my 20th year high school reunion this weekend, and it's just, that's, so there's a myth of a kingdom there, right, that we all shared and then left 20 years ago. So this, it's just very human at the same time. But you create it by projecting it. It's not one or the other. So I hope that's...
Yeah, I think you just connect with whatever you connect with. There's, I think, like, you don't have to buy into anything if it doesn't feel... You don't have to convince yourself of anything, like, oh, I have to imagine myself in the... You know,
yeah.
No. You know, for some people, you know, that kind of indigenous storytelling is, you know, makes more sense. But I think
you know, I've not experienced anything in Shambhala where it's like you have to buy into it. And in fact, you know, have a little skepticism, have doubt, right? Have questions. Don't give that up, you know, and there may be things you never connect with, and that's totally fine.
So thank you so much, Ante, and thank you all. And
thank you all for being here.
For sharing our story.
On Tuesday night.
Thank you, Dr. Shante Smalls. Thank you, Shastri Ethan Nickturn. That was cool, right? That was cool. I thought that was cool. Hey, visit us at ny.shambhala.org for more information about classes and weekend retreats. If you live in or near New York City, you're welcome to come hear these talks live at a weekly Dharma gathering every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. Email us at ny.shambhala.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions, air conditioner, filter, anecdotes. And tell your friends about the podcast. Enjoy your week. Later.